Good afternoon, everyone. Very nice to be here with you for the Sabbath. I have to pass along greetings from my wife as well. We are leaving quite early tomorrow morning, heading for Bangkok, and so she didn't think she could make the trip out here. She needs to rest up a little bit in preparation for that, but I'm very happy to be able to be here with you and look forward to being able to get to know some of you here as I was able to do before services, a little bit at least. Let's see, it looks like I may have some technical issues here. Start this over real quick. What I would like to do today, brethren, is give you an overview of some things that are going on in other parts of the world, in particular the French-speaking regions of the world. This is not unusual. Actually, before I get into that, there were a couple of things I wanted to say. First of all, about the Philippines, I was able to check with Mr. David Baker, our regional director for that area, and all of our church brethren from Cagua, at least, are accounted for. There may be some on the island of Leyte in United that may have been affected. We don't have news of them yet, but at least as far as the Cagua members, everyone's accounted for. And I also wanted to mention that we are in the process of becoming Texans. But I wanted to let you know that I actually had a little bit of a head start on that because my mom was raised in Texas as a girl, and so I grew up with Texas things sometimes, cuisine, if you can call it that, I guess, and stories of Texas. My grandfather was a crew chief on a roughneck crew for Hughes Tool and Die, and so we would go and visit them in this area. They were, I think, in Oklahoma by that time. But so I do have a little, it's in my blood someplace, and it shouldn't take too long for it to catch, I think. So anyways, I was saying I would like to give you an update on what you are helping to support in other parts of the world. There's a precedent for this. If you'll turn with me to Acts chapter 14, verse 26. This is a passage here about one of the Apostle Paul's what are sometimes called evangelical or evangelistic tours. And he actually would go on these long trips, and they would last years. And he would go through much of the Roman world, visiting, preaching the gospel, or visiting church members. And this is the passage where we are here now, is right at the end of his first evangelistic voyage. So in Acts chapter 14 and verse 26, it says, "From there, they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they had completed. And when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them, and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. So they stayed there a long time with the disciples." So the church at Antioch was instrumental in allowing the Apostle Paul to do what he was doing. They helped with their prayers and their financial support so that he could go and preach the gospel in other parts of the world. And when he got back from this long trip, the first thing he did was gather the church together and tell them the news. This is what's happening in other parts of the world. God has opened the door of faith to people of other lands who are now being called to the truth. So I think that's a biblical precedent for what we're going to do today. I would like to just take some time and show you some photos and explain a little bit about what's going on in other parts of the world. I hope that you will find this interesting. I hope you'll remember some of these people in your prayers. And then after we go through some of these slides, I will try to tie some of this together with a lesson that I believe is helpful for all of us to keep in mind and that we can mull over in the week to come. Just make sure that, do we have video up on the screen? Okay. Now, if you watch that globe carefully, you'll be hypnotized in about 2 minutes, I think. So what we're going to do now is just give you an overview on the French-speaking part of the work of the Church of God, a worldwide association. These are the areas in the world where we have French-speaking members, or at least members who are living in countries where French is the predominant European language. In some of the places that I'm going to show you, actually the members themselves, many of them don't speak French, but the leaders speak French, the educated people in the country speak French, and so we have to deal with members in French. And I'll just say a word about why that is. After English, French is one of the most useful languages to speak when one travels internationally. France was a major colonizing power just behind England in that department. And so there are a lot of places in the world that were colonized by France, or in some cases Belgium. And what the colonizing countries leave behind, even at independence, they leave their language and they leave certain aspects of their culture behind as well. So especially in Africa, French is very widely spoken because there were a lot of French colonies there. And using English and French, you can go just about anywhere in Africa and make your way. There are a couple of places that speak Portuguese, but essentially it's English and French. But not only do you find French in Africa, you find it in the Caribbean, you find it in the Indian Ocean, you find it in places in the South Pacific and Southeast Asia as well. So French is a very, very widely spoken language because of that colonial background. Now, the larger the circle here on this map, which I hope you can all see, the size of the circle indicates more or fewer members or people attending services there. So these are the places that we're going to have a quick look at today. I wanted to show you a couple of things that we have put together to be able to serve our brethren in scattered areas. We do have a website, not a very elaborate one yet. We are working very hard now to come out with the Life, Hope, and Truth website in French. We should be able to do that before the end of the year. But we did set one up 2 years ago. We have a website, as you can see here. You get a picture of it. And on this website, there is literature available. There are sermons to be downloaded. There are calendars. There are weekly newsletters that are sent out from here. There are translations of the letters from Mr. Franks. And really, we translate as much as we can. We also we have a weekly newsletter, as I mentioned, which looks something like this, and it is sent out in PDF form every Friday. And we also make hard copies available for those who don't have access to the Internet. And then after that, we also translate One Accord, and that comes out. We're a couple of weeks behind the English edition, but we do translate that, do the page layouts, and make that available to our French-speaking brethren as well. So the French department, as we sometimes call it, that's a bit grandiose because the French department is two people. I'm half of it, and Mr. Bernard Angelo, who's another elder in Cagua, is the other half. He does the bulk of our translating and helps out preparing sermons and recording them. And between the two of us, basically, we attempt to keep up to date on all of these things. We have come out with a couple of booklets, actually three booklets in French as well, because a lot of the places where we go in Africa and where we have brethren, they are not able to access the Internet or not able to access it easily. So we have a booklet on the Sabbath, as you can see on the right, our fundamentals of beliefs on the actually on the left and on the right, and then we have a booklet on the holy days as well. And these are basically just booklets that have been put together from the Bible question and answers that we have on our websites, and we edit them and modify them, and we're able to come up with a booklet that explains the fundamental truths on these topics. This is a photo from our Feast of Tabernacles in France this year, and I will just say a word about that. We had 80 people that attended this year in France. Many of those were visitors. We do really enjoy having visitors in France, and this is a little mountaintop vacation colony that we rented. We were the only ones there. There was just the staff and us. There were no other guests. So it was really very, very millennial. If you're ever thinking of going international for the feast, I would encourage you to consider France as an option. Many people who come and keep the feast in France comment that it's like no other place that they've been for the feast, for the reason that we do everything together. When you come to the feast in France, you pay one set price, which is usually around $500 to $600 per person, and that pays for your lodging and all your meals, three meals a day, and that includes wine with lunch and dinner if you would care to have some. And we don't waste any time driving around or whatever. It's just we're all there. The services are there, lodgings are there, meals are there. So there's just lots and lots of time for fellowship. We do have coach excursions on non-Sabbath days so that we can go and visit sites of interest in the area. But even there, everybody's together. We're all on the buses together. And so there's just lots and lots of time for fellowship. It obviously you have to pay the plane ticket to get there. However, once you're in France, it's actually quite economical. You would spend more going to Hawaii for the feast than you would spend to go to France for the feast. Services alternate from one day to the next between French and English. One day services are in French, the next day in English. And then we have a simultaneous translation goes whichever way we need to go, and you just listen in on a little FM radio. We have excellent translators, so you really don't miss much at all at the feast. Here we are. These are some of our French members enjoying a meal. The ones on the right are actually from Belgium, And then the gentleman on the left side of the photo is Mr. James Muir, longtime elder in the church who serves members in France. That's his wife next to him. And you can see the meals are served kind of family style, and we take a long time to eat in France. These are 3, 4, 5-course meals, depending on the day, which includes there's always French cheese and dessert, and it's really very nice. Here we have some other members. Most of the people on the right side of this photo are from Switzerland, also the French-speaking part of Switzerland. And the lady on the lower left is from Colombia, I believe. So we have people from all over. We generally have people from England, have people from the States. So lots of people with whom you can fellowship. So I would encourage you to think about coming to France sometime if you'd like to travel internationally for the feast. Okay, the red dot that you see here now is indicating the location of the French island of Martinique in the Caribbean. Martinique is actually part of France, the way Hawaii is an American state. It's part of the United States. There are American citizens that live in Hawaii. It's the same thing with the people of Martinique and Guadeloupe. They are French citizens, even though they live a long way from mainland or metropolitan France, as it's called. This is a very beautiful island, as are many of the islands in the Caribbean. It's a vacation destination for mostly French-speaking people. Beautiful beaches, some dark sand, some very fine powdery white sand. This beach, Saline, on the southern part of the island, is always voted in the top 5 beaches in the Caribbean by people who vote on things like that, I guess. So it is really a very beautiful environment. And these are the members, these are the people who attend services there. There's a little group of about a dozen. Many of these people go back to Worldwide Days, so they've been in the church a long time. The gentleman on the far right there is a deacon. His name is Mr. Eugenie, and he and his wife are very faithful pillars in the congregation there. We had several baptisms there recently, mostly young people who grew up in the church. So there's some growth occurring there, and these people have a pretty good standard of living. It's not what we would enjoy here in the States, but since they're French citizens, they have French law, they use the euro as their currency, and unemployment is a big problem for them, as it is on many small islands, because it's just difficult to have that kind of economy. But basically, they have a pretty comfortable life, and they only receive a visit once a year. I try to get there once a year to visit them for a Sabbath or sometimes 2 Sabbaths, then the rest of the time it's all remote with recorded sermons and things of that nature. Now we're going to go all the way to the other side of the world. We're going from the Caribbean to the Indian Ocean. And there are a couple of little islands in the Indian Ocean where French is the main language that's spoken. One of these islands is actually, again, part of France. France has a little island there called Réunion, and it is what the French call an overseas department. It would be like a state to us. And on that little island, there are 2 people, a husband and his wife, who've been faithful members of the church for 30-plus years, long, long time. And then on the other island, which is the island of Mauritius, where we'll start, also a wonderful paradise. Mark Twain visited it on his trip around the world and made the comment that you got the idea that God created paradise on the 7th day, I think it was, and then he created Mauritius after that. And so it was an improvement. It really is a very beautiful island. Some of you probably recognize this. This is the dodo bird. And why do I mention that? Because Mauritius was the place where the dodo bird originally lived. It was the only place in the world where it was found. And there were no people on Mauritius when it was discovered in the 1600s. There were only animals living there, no people. And so the animals had no fear of the sailors that came ashore because they'd never encountered a predator before. And, of course, the sailors, when they arrived there after months on the seas without any fresh anything, what they wanted was some fresh meat. And so they could just walk up to a dodo with a rock and bean it and cook it and eat it. And that's what they did until there were no more. And, of course, the sailors thought that was rather dumb on the part of the dodo not to try to get away. They didn't understand that behavior. And that's why if we call someone a dodo today, we're not complimenting them. And that's the reason why that happened. So little parenthetical thought about Mauritius. I mentioned that there were no people originally on Mauritius. So who lives there now? Well, the descendants of people that were brought in by the different colonial powers. Mauritius belonged to different countries at different times, and the Dutch controlled it for a while. The French kicked the Dutch out, then the English and the French fought over it, and the English got it. And so most of the people on Mauritius can get along reasonably well in both French and English. And the French brought in slaves from Africa and from Madagascar. The British later brought in Indians from East India and also from Sri Lanka, and as civil servants to work in their administration. And so what you have on this island now is a mix of people from Madagascar, from Africa, from India, a few Europeans thrown in. You have Muslims and Christians, and you have different varieties of Christians. You have Sikhs. You have a great hodgepodge of religions and cultures. And the really amazing thing is everybody gets along pretty well. That's one of the few places in the world where you could say that. You also have a big mix of old and new. You see some very cutting-edge technology, but you also see some things being done the old way, like this marketplace, which is what you were looking down on a moment ago from my hotel window. People like to do their shopping like this. The pace of life is very slow. They're not in a hurry. They take their time. And you can see in the faces of the people and in their dress some of the different origins of the people who live on Mauritius now. This is a little group that attends services in Mauritius. There was a fairly good-sized congregation and worldwide, and there are not all of the members who attend are pictured in this photo. There are a few other members on the island as well, but this was a group I was able to take a photo of. They're more comfortable in French than in English, which is why we serve them from the French department. And we organize the Feast of Tabernacles, or help them organize it, and we make available to them the literature that we have. They get one visit a year, and they really feel rather cut off in many ways because they are. It's really the other side of the world. To get there, you have to fly all the way to Europe. When you get to Europe, you're not quite halfway there yet, so you have to turn around and make another trip that long again, 12 hours from Paris, to get there, and it's just it takes a very long time to get there. So they don't have visitors very often, but they do welcome them warmly. They had a few visitors with them for the feast this year and really, really appreciated it. So if you want to go someplace really unusual for the feast, where your presence would really make a difference for our brethren, this would be the place. They have a wonderful tourist infrastructure, everything from inexpensive hotels to five-star hotels, wonderful cuisine that's really not expensive, so it's a very nice place to go for the feast. This is Jocelyn and Salonie Prodigue. They are kind of our lead members there. Services are often held in their living room. They both work in offices. This is the night to be much observed. Last year we had it in their dining room with other members of the church, and also a couple of family members that don't attend church were invited as well. So the meals are very interesting there because of all the cultural background. If you have a meal there, chances are one dish will be Chinese, one dish will be Creole, one dish will be Indian. Maybe they'll throw in a cheese from France, and they, you know, it's quite varied, and it's actually very nice, very pleasant. Now we'll move over to the other island. I mentioned Reunion is the French island. The members there are French citizens. This is Laval and Patricia Prodigue. Laval is Jocelyn's brother. Those two are brothers. But these two are French citizens, and so they never learned English, and they speak only French. And they feel, as you can imagine, even more isolated than the other group does because they're just the two of them, and I'm able to see them once a year. Sometimes not even that. If I get really pushed for time, I'm only able to go to Mauritius and not Reunion. I do intend to visit them in January, February of this year. But they're very faithfully there and very, very aware of what's going on the Internet as far as our church is concerned because that's kind of their lifeline. They watch the sermons being posted. They check out all the new literature and so on. So you might think of them. They feel a little bit lonely on their island, as you can imagine. Now we're going to move over into East Africa. This is an area that has seen a lot of trouble in the course of the past decades because it's an area of great mineral wealth. The area of the Eastern Congo is one of the wealthiest places in the world as far as rare minerals. If you have a cell phone on you right now, probably an element of that cell phone came from Eastern Congo. There are some minerals that are so rare that they're almost only found there. And as a result of it, there's a lot of fighting over that. If a warlord can manage to get control of it, even for a year, he can become very, very wealthy, and that's what they try to do. So there are There are actually three countries here where we have members in this zone, Rwanda, Burundi, and the Congo, and we'll talk a little bit more about each of them. I'll show you some photos here. Rwanda, if you recall, maybe you've seen the movie Hotel Rwanda or you know a little bit about that, you will recall that in 1994 there was a terrible genocide that occurred. Between 800,000 and 1 million people were killed in the space of 2 months, mostly in the space of just a few weeks. And this is one of the smallest countries in Africa. So to imagine 1 million dead or close to 1 million dead in such a small area, really there were just bodies everywhere. Our church brethren at the time had to flee the country for safety. They left to try to get into Goma in the Congo, the border area. Goma is still in the news now. There's been more fighting there recently. This area always seems to be simmering on the verge of boiling over, and that's still the case almost 20 years later now. These are some photos that were taken after the fact, the piles of remains, the bodies that were killed. This was a visit that I was able to make with my family in 2006. These are my daughters standing in a genocide memorial in a place called Ntarama, just outside the capital of Kigali. You see they're standing on pews in this little church. Churches had previously been places of refuge. If you could get on holy ground, as people thought of it, then the killing stopped. But this time, in 1994, they just continued. So there were a lot of people trying to find a place of safety who would cram into these little churches or on the church grounds, and this time they were just slaughtered. So in this little church and on the grounds around it, the official sign says estimates are about 5,000 people were murdered. Many of them were packed into this little church. And there are people who deny that this ever happened in Rwanda, just like there are people who deny the Jews being killed in World War II. And so for a number of years, the government just left the churches as they were found when people moved back into this area after the trouble. So what you're seeing on the ground here in this church or on the floor, those are human bones. And they just left them piled there where they were, where the people fell, to illustrate the gravity and the scale of what occurred. You may recall a couple of years ago in a festival video, 2 or 3 years ago, Mr. and Mrs. Mundelli were featured. They had hid young people up over a false ceiling in their house to protect them from militia that were coming to kill them. And Mrs. Mundelli was struck with a rifle butt, knocked to the ground. She thought she was going to die and feels like God intervened at the last minute to protect her. And they actually were able to save several of the young people that they had hidden. One fell through the ceiling, got nervous and moved and fell through the ceiling, and that young person was taken away and killed with a machete just a few feet from the house. So our brethren over there lived through some extremely intense and trying times. They had to leave their homes not knowing if they would ever be able to come back to them or what they would find if they could. And they saw some very disturbing things with their own eyes and really had to trust in God for their safety. And this is a photo I took during one of my visits there. They're still finding people that were hastily buried in the muddy ground, which tends to preserve the bodies. So when one is found, they disinter them and try to give them a decent burial in a coffin. This was in a church that was acting as a processing center. And in the middle of all of that darkness and awfulness, there is quite a flourishing congregation of the Church of God. Now, this is most of the members in Rwanda who are gathered together in front of their little church hall. You can see Mr. Mundelli with the white hair over here on this side of the screen, and you can see Mr. Franks over on the right side. He made a church visit there with me last year, and the members there were very excited to know that the president of our church association would go all the way into rural eastern Africa in order to meet them and visit with them. And one of them made the comment, this is proof that we really are important as members of the Church of God, if the president will come to visit us. And so that was very encouraging for them. And Mr. Franks also appreciated the opportunity to meet them and get to see where they attend services. This is a rural village up on top of a hillside. There's no electricity. There's no running water. The outbuilding that you see on the left here is a cistern, which we built to catch rainwater. This is also the feast site that they use. And the wooden structures that you see to the right of the building, those are actually frameworks over which they put tarps to create booths for the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's where they stay during the time of the feast. We got a small generator for them so they can have some electric light at night, so they can continue the activities of the evening past sundown. we probably wouldn't think of that here, but on the equator, this is just slightly south of the equator, the sun always rises and sets at the same time. The days are always 12 hours long and the nights are always 12 hours long. And basically, the sun rises at 6 and it sets at 6, and there's very little variation in that time through the year. So you have to kind of roll up the sidewalks at 6 unless you've got some form of power to turn a light bulb on, which we thankfully we do there. They're getting ready to build a kitchen for the use of the Feast of Tabernacles. This is how you start building something in Rwanda. And then you fill that in with wood bricks. These are the frameworks for the booths. Here we're building some latrines, long drop latrines, for the use of the members. And I wanted to show you this. This is the house of one of our members. This is a typical house of what your church brethren live in Giti, this village in Rwanda, and what a lot of your church brethren in Africa would live in. It's made out of, there's that wooden framework that you saw from the previous slides, and then they put mud brick in between them, and then they put a mix of, they mix together a little bit of concrete, some more mud, and cow dung. I'm not sure what purpose that serves, but that's the other ingredient. And then they can spread that out over the house, and it hardens it against the rain. And with proper maintenance, this can last 20 or 30 years. It doesn't usually last more than that. You have to start over and rebuild a new one after 30 years or so. And they can try to reuse the corrugated tin on the roof when they build a new house. But this is, the family name is, you're probably not going to be able to pronounce this, Ruchamunyanyi. And his first name is Etienne, which means Stephen in French. And this is, so this is their family house. This is the inside, dirt floor, but very clean, always swept. You can see the kind of tables and chairs that they're using here. And they were very happy. You can see Etienne is smiling. He's very happy that we would come and visit him in his home. He's really happy here. You see the big smile on his face. He's happy because what his standing in front of him represents a little bit of cushion, a little financial safety. He's got a cow and two goats here. And that means he's doing okay. He's got a little bit in reserve against something unforeseen that might come up in the future. With a cow, you can get some milk. You might also get a calf later on or something of that nature. So this represents some hope for the future. And the other reason he's smiling is he thinks it's sort of preposterous for a Westerner to come and take a picture of his cow and his goats. And he can't figure out why I'm so interested in his cow and his goats. But it's so I could show you. That's why I took the picture. Now we're moving down to the next country down, which is Burundi. Burundi also has the same mix of ethnic groups. It's also Hutu and Tutsi, between whom the ethnic tensions were exacerbated to the point of the Hutu-led genocide against the Tutsis. The Tutsis were almost entirely wiped out in Rwanda, and there's been that kind of tension in Burundi as well. This is looking down on the capital city of Bujumbura in Burundi on the shores of Lake Tanganyika. You might be surprised to learn that this lake, it's a very long lake, it's one of the longest lakes in the world, 450 miles long, as I recall, maybe 500 miles long, and it's also the second largest lake in the world by volume. It holds more water than any of our Great Lakes, for example. That's to give you an idea of the scale. At its deepest point, it's nearly 5,000 feet deep. So it's a part of the Great Rift that runs up from southern Africa through Kenya. You hear about the Great Rift Valley. This is part of the same formation. And it actually runs all the way up into Israel. The Dead Sea in Israel is part of that same rift system that runs up the whole coast of Africa. So this is all part of that same system. This is on the shores of Lake Tanganyika. It's a freshwater lake, lots of fish. It was almost fished out at one point, but there's still a lot of fish, and the fish are absolutely essential to the survival of people in this area. Most of the protein that people can get, at least animal protein, is fish. There's more fish consumed than any other kind of animal protein. The other interesting thing about this area, this is right near the mouth of the Rusizi River, which brings water into this lake. And the Rusizi is also famous for a fellow named Gustav. Anybody heard of Gustav? Gustav is a Nile crocodile who currently holds the record for having eaten more people than any other crocodile known in the world. He's very large, and when he's spotted, there are announcements on all of the radio stations in the area. Watch out, Gustav's been sighted. They want to warn people so that people going down to the river to get water in the morning, pay attention, because that's usually where Gustav grabs somebody. Just a little local flavor here, but these are the kinds of things some of your church brethren have to deal with in other parts of the world. This is the road leading north to where most of our church brethren live. They live up in the north of the country, close to the Rwandan border. And these fellows are making their living with a bicycle. This is one of the poorest countries in the world, certainly in Africa. And so the people lead a very subsistence sort of life. What these guys are doing is they're biking fodder in from the countryside to people who might have goats or a cow in the city. They will run out of grass for their animals, so they'll have to buy it by the bike load. So these fellows will bike out into the country, cut the grass, bicycle it back in, and sell it in town. I like to think of this as the bicycle capitalism capital of the world, because it seems to me as I drive around on the roads in Burundi, everything is transported on bicycle, including things you wouldn't believe could be transported on a bicycle. I've seen couches like you would have in your living room. I've seen that on the back of a bicycle. That's not that uncommon. Armchairs, entire full cans of cow's milk, the same kind of cans that you would think of over here. A bed. I've seen a bed on the back of one of these before, entirely assembled. And they can get as many as three or four people on one bicycle as well. So it's quite interesting and amazing and amusing to watch these people as they're trying to get by. A lot of subsistence farming also. They're in a rice paddy here, as you can see. And here's our congregation. These are not all of the people in Burundi, but as many as we're able to gather together in one place. I'm the one over here on the left, if you're having any trouble picking me out. And the gentleman all the way on the right over there is our elder, I just ordained him last year, Mr. Nathan Mokeshimana, and I'll show you a photo of him in a moment. So we have about 200 to 250, actually more like 250 people attending. We had a little under 200 at the feast this year. This is a new church building. We just got the roof on in time for the Feast of Tabernacles this year, and this was their feast site. So they're very excited to have a hall that will seat more than 300. So they have some room to grow here, and this is where they kept the Feast of Tabernacles this year. This is another church hall. We now have three there. We have three different congregations that meet in three different places. This one is called Masango, and it's pretty far off the beaten track, actually all three of them are. I do hold leadership training for the local leaders. I found that's one of the best uses of my time while I'm there, to go through our fundamental doctrines, our fundamental beliefs, make sure they really understand the truths of the Bible, because they're going to be responsible for helping their brethren learn these things and know how to apply them and how to live them. We do prepare these trifolds. It's basically a long sheet of paper that's folded a couple of times. And this is a very effective, inexpensive way for us to allow them to produce their own literature as they need. We can leave a sample for them. They can go in and have some photocopies made when there are needs to distribute them. And it works well in this environment. Here are a couple of them. The one on the left is talking about, did Jesus die on Good Friday to be resurrected on Easter Sunday? In the middle, there's one on how should we pray so that God will answer us. And on the right, it's the question of the Sabbath. Is it to be now observed on Sunday? And we have a number of these that we've made available to them. This is what leadership training seminars look like in Burundi. Inside the church, dirt floor still. A paved floor is still a long time away for this area. There's a table and a couple of chairs usually for those giving the conference. Everyone else sits on wooden benches. And we just talk and study the Bible together to make sure that there's a good understanding. This is lunch being prepared right next to the church hall. A couple of volunteers working on that. And this is what it looks like when it ends up on our table. There's some rice, there's some onions, potatoes. That's for me because they know I like potatoes. They actually prefer yams themselves, but when I'm there, they usually come up with a few potatoes for me. And very special, this pot right up here, there's some beef in there. Why is that special? It's probably the toughest beef you would ever have tried to chew on in your life. And they are really happy to have it because the poverty level is such in this part of the world that the average person in Burundi is going to eat meat once or twice a year. And all of the rest of the time they're getting protein from mixing beans and rice or lentils or something of that nature. So if we can provide them a really tough, chewy piece of beef, they are very thankful and really appreciative. So that's what we try to make available to them during the Feast of Tabernacles as well. Most people are poor enough in this area that they don't have any kind of cutlery or silverware in the house, so everyone's used to eating with their hands. They do wash up before. They usually manage to have some soap and water. At least when I'm there, they do. So we can wash our hands before we eat, and they're very adept at doing that. This is where they were meeting before. We've managed to get the roof on the building just before the Feast of Tabernacles this year. They just had some tarps and strung them up over wooden poles. As you can see, that works okay during the dry season. It really doesn't work well at all during the rainy season. I know I didn't think to put the photo in here, but I have a photo of myself standing inside a church hall with somebody holding an umbrella over my head. We were inside, but there were enough holes in the roof that I needed an umbrella to keep my Bible dry while I was speaking to them. So conditions can be rather challenging here sometimes. I really like this photo because it says a lot about not only what life is like there, but how ingenious people can be in this part of the world. Necessity is the mother of invention. You see that they've managed to acquire an old electric organ, but of course there's no electricity in this village. So how do you solve that problem? Well, you solve it by hooking it up to the car battery, which is down here. And then when you're done with the service, you put the car battery back in the car and you drive the car around a little bit to recharge it, and you're ready to go for next time. So they can fix almost anything. Things that we would throw away, they would fix. In fact, some of the things that you throw away here end up in Africa. One of the first trips that I made to Ghana early on in my work in Africa, I met a lady after church services, and she was wearing a T-shirt that said Wisconsin Dells on it. And I know she'd never been to the Dells. So a lot of things that you discard, use clothing, used all sorts of things, that can be bundled up and sent over there and sold. So there's a lot of American T-shirts. I see people wearing T-shirts with American football teams on it and baseball teams and all that sort of thing. It's very common. They have no idea what it means. It's just a shirt for them. So they really make do with what they have. This is our elder from Rwanda, Mr. Mundeli, who comes with me sometimes in Burundi. The languages are very close to each other. In both Rwanda and Burundi, I have to work through a translator because not everyone speaks French. Some do, but many do not. So when I give a sermon there or a Bible study, I'll say a sentence, it gets translated. And I say another sentence, and it gets translated, which is a very slow way to give a message. And it means you can only say about half as much as you normally would because everything has to be said twice. So I like to have Mr. Mundeli speak when possible because he can just speak in their local dialect, and they can understand him. This is what a service looked like last year before we got the building up. Here we are doing the blessing of the little children. There are a lot of children in Africa, and I had another example of that here. They asked me right before services, it's been a while since you've been here, can you have a blessing of the little children? And I said, well, how many are there, because we've got a pretty full schedule. They said there are five. I said, okay, five, we can fit that in, so we'll do it during the service. So when it came time for announcements, I read the passages about the blessing of the little children, and I asked the parents who had not had their children blessed yet and wanted to have them blessed to please come forward. And 16 came forward. So it was a very short sermon during that service. We did manage to get them all blessed, but it took about half the sermon time, I think. And here's the ordination of Mr. Mokeshimana, our elder there. He was originally an elder in the Church of God Seventh Day. Came in contact with our church group, and was very struck by the holy days, the meaning of the holy days, and we've been working with him now for 6 or 7 years, and was very good to reach the point where we could ordain him. I should mention another story, which will give you an idea of what can happen in this part of the world, that they don't have some of the same basic freedoms that we still can take for granted, although some of them are being eroded at this point. I was in my office in Milford, Ohio, and I got a phone call, and it was a government official from Burundi. And he spoke to me in French. He said, do you know Nathan Mokeshimana? I said, yes. He said, is he a part of your church? I said, well, we're working toward being together. I know who he is. We do work with him. And he said, okay, thank you. And the next thing I heard, that was kind of the end of that conversation. The next thing, I got a call from this fellow, Muiz, and he said, Nathan's in jail. I said, well, what happened? They said, well, the officials realized that he was preaching and that he was connected to a church in the United States, and we're not recognized here legally in Burundi. We've been off the radar scope. We've been so small. But now that they realize that there's an American church connected with him, they're going to hold him in jail until we get registered with the government, until the government gives us approval to function. So we hurried up and started the paperwork, and it took us about 10 days to get registered there finally. We sent some money over and the paperwork and all of that. And they held him in jail for 10 days until he could get registered. And the offense was practicing religion without a government license, without a government approval. You have to be recognized and accepted by the government as a church before you can even preach. I mean, he wasn't doing business or anything. He was just holding a Bible study, and he got arrested for it. So those are other kinds of conditions that people over there deal with that we don't have to deal with here. This is Nathan after his ordination. His wife doesn't look too happy. That's not because she was disappointed that he was ordained. I need to tell you the story about smiling for photos in Africa. I learned this early on again when I would go. I'd get a group of people together, and they'd be smiling, you know, and they're happy to be together, happy to have a visit. And then when I get them lined up for the photo, all of a sudden everyone would look very serious and kind of grim. And I would try to get them to smile, you know, smile for the photo. And they look at each other like, is he crazy? Smile for the photo? And so I finally asked someone, explain this to me. Why don't you smile for pictures? And they said, well, it's because in Africa, you only smile if something good has happened to you. And that basically means you've come into some money. The only time people smile is when they have some money, they've come into some money. And in Africa, the way our families work, if one family member comes into some money, he has to share with the rest of the family. So if we go around smiling, all our relatives are going to want their share. And since we don't have any money, they're going to think we're lying to them and we're trying to keep the money, and it just causes too many problems, so we don't smile for photos. And it's true, if you see Africans in photos, even outside the church context, they're not going to smile for the camera. So she's doing the Burundian thing she's actually happy, but this is for the photo. I finally, after a lot of convincing, I said, look, I'm not going to show your relatives. This will only be shown in America. Your relatives will never see it. And finally, timidly, they began to smile a little bit, and then they kind of titter about it because it was just ridiculous to think of smiling for a photo. So. And these are many of the brethren in Burundi, and they're all waving. I asked them if they had a message for their church brethren elsewhere in the United States and elsewhere, and they waved and smiled for this one because they're saying thank you for the support that the church makes available to them. They really do appreciate the visits they receive, the literature that's provided, the help to have a building, the education that is provided, and a lot of that comes from here. So think of this as them thanking you for your faithful participation in the work of the church and your support by prayer for what we're trying to do over there. Okay, we're going to move now to the next country over, which is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is oddly named because it is neither democratic nor a republic, really, but that's what they've chosen to call it. There are two Congos in Africa. The country, the little brown country, just diagonally up and to the left is also a Congo. It's called the Republic of Congo. That's a former French colony. And the Democratic Republic of the Congo is a former Belgian colony. They don't get along very well with each other, even though they both speak French now. We have two groups of people in the Congo, as you can see from these two circles. The circle on the left is the capital city of Kinshasa, where the central government is. And the circle on the right is this war-torn area around the Bukavu and Goma area, right along the border with Rwanda. And there we have one large family who lives in Bukavu, and the father works for a university there. They have had on several occasions to flee their homes and go someplace else because the fighting has gotten too close. We have a hard time keeping in touch with them sometimes because cell phone service is not can't always be counted on. But there's this area, the circle on the right, is where a lot of the fighting that you hear about in Africa is going on, the Congolese areas, the M23 that was just finally beaten by the central government troops of Kinshasa. So I'll show you some photos of this area now. There's been a lot of fighting. This is the lake area where a lot of the fighting has happened. These are not my photos. Not that I couldn't take photos of guys with guns. It's very easy to find that. If you go to this area, you're going to see a lot of firearms, and chances are at some point they'll be pointed at you. That's not uncommon either. But I don't have my own pictures to show you because the decorum in Africa is you don't take pictures of anybody with a gun because they might shoot you. That does happen sometimes. They don't like to have their pictures taken, and they want you to respect them. And so I just keep the camera put away when I'm around fellows looking like this. Sometimes the violence spills over beyond actual military troops, and neighbors will start fighting each other. Different ethnic groups will fight each other, and it can get extremely violent and very disturbing. I mean, the cruelty is really barbaric at times. This happened in Ivory Coast just recently, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get to Ivory Coast. These are refugees just recently who are fleeing the fighting around Goma, which is on the border with Rwanda. And this is the family that lives in Bukavu. I've been over as far as the border to visit them on the Rwandan side. They can come across the border. This is the Brume family with not all of their children, but most of the children. And they made the trip all the way over. We sent them some assistance so that they could come and meet Mr. Franks when he came to the area here. So he was able to meet them. They were able to meet him as well. And they were very thankful to have been able to make this trip and to meet with their church brethren in Rwanda. Now we've gone over to the other circle. This is Kinshasa, the capital of Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo. That's the Congo River that you see in the background there. This is one of the most corrupt governments and corrupt places in the world. It's a very violent place. There's a lot of crime. If you check on the website, the U.S. government basically says don't go there. And yet, in that type of environment, there's a small congregation of the Church of God that is holding to the truth and trying to teach their children the right way to live. And they're looking forward to the kingdom of God, just the way you and I are. So here we have the Congo River at one of the cataracts. The infrastructure has basically just gone completely. There was such corruption in Congo under Mobutu that everything was just allowed to fall apart because all of the money was going into his pocket. They actually invented a new term for the government of the Congo in those years. You know, you have democracy, you can have a republic, and you can have autocracy. They invented a new term for Congo. They called it a kleptocracy. You know what a kleptomaniac is, somebody who can't help but steal. Well, klepto is the prefix that means a thief. So they had a kleptocracy, government by the thieves, and that's basically what it was. Anybody who came into a position of power knew he wasn't going to have it very long, so he used it to line his pockets and his family's pockets at the expense of the rest of the country. So it just really hit rock bottom. Now, things seem to be starting to improve a little bit, but honestly, I don't see how they could have gotten worse. So a lot of the roads, even in the center of the city, they're not paved. It's just dirt road, dust roads. The pavement's long gone. The vehicles are falling apart. The UN is present. There are more UN peacekeepers in Congo than any place else in the world. And usually when the UN arrives, prices start going up because the UN is flush with money, your tax dollars at work. And they will go in and they will buy up the good properties. They'll take the good real estate for things for their military operations and what have you. And that drives the prices up for everybody else. So it really makes life very difficult. And as I said, in the middle of that kind of environment, there is a little Church of God group, faithfully a part of our association, and they are having Sabbath services every Sabbath. They're teaching the commandments to their children. They're having difficulty keeping their children in school sometimes. We try to monitor that with them and help them as we're able to. They're keeping the holy days, kept the Feast of Tabernacles again this year, which they just learned about 6 or 7 years ago. And they're trying to do the same things that you and I are trying to do, but they're just doing it under very much more difficult circumstances. This is after a church service in Kinshasa. We're having a snack, peanuts, a piece of bread, and a soda. That's pretty good for that area. And now we're going over to Togo in West Africa. It's a very long, thin little country. This is flying in, about to land in the airport. You see the red dust of Africa. The dirt's very red almost through the whole continent. This is the kind of thing you see commonly all through Africa along the side of the road. Someone will just bring out a table, plop it down in the dirt, and sell whatever he's going to sell on the table there. And a lot of the commerce in the country happens like that. This is a wildcat gas station. You notice he's got glass bottles, old whiskey bottles filled with gasoline up here. And he's got different sizes of them. It looks like he's got about a 5-liter bottle in his hand there. Plastic used to be a water bottle. This is the price on the chalkboard, 550 francs per liter. And they'll just wait till people pull up. You tell them how many liters you want, and in the car it goes. A lot of times this is bootleg gasoline from Nigeria, which has been stolen. Every once in a while we hear about an explosion in Nigeria because people are so poor there that when they get to the gas viaducts, these big pipes that carry gasoline from the refineries, they'll actually go up with a hammer and poke a hole in it and catch as much gas as they can and take off with it to sell it someplace. And some of it ends up in other countries. But every once in a while, you know what happens when you hit something metal with something metal? All you need is one spark and the whole place goes up. And that happens periodically in Nigeria. You'll hear about that if you listen to the news. The reason that there are so many little gas stations like this is because of the taxis. Taxi drivers usually don't own their own car. They rent it by the day, or if it's a motorcycle, they rent it by the day. They have to pay maybe $5 or $10 to use the car for a day. And then whatever they can make above and beyond that, that's what they get to take home with them. Well, one thing they don't want to do is leave any gas in the gas tank, as you can imagine. So they're always running on fumes. And I've seen this happen before. They will run it. Sometimes it'll run out completely. And they'll coast as far as they can as the engine's kind of knocking and dying. And they'll hope to make it to one of these places. So about every 300 or 400 yards, you're going to find one of these for the taxis who are running, you know, they couldn't make it any farther. This is our little group in Lomé in Togo. And a very faithful group. Several of the men here have the privilege of being quite well educated, especially by local standards, and so they're able to do pretty well. Two of these men actually have their own cars, which is very, very rare in Africa. They're doing very well. They feel very blessed, and they were able to see through all the things that were going on in our previous association by reading the documentation. They discerned exactly what was going on and informed me, got in touch with me, said, we know what's going on and we know where we want to go. So the gift of discernment was very clearly in evidence here. This is what it looks like before services. We're getting ready to have a Sabbath service. You notice bars on all the windows. Kind of looks like a prison. They have to do that because of theft and burglaries, which is very common here. So everything has to be protected. This is Anna, one of the members, about to serve me some salad for lunch. And these are the little twins, beautiful little girls, very well behaved. Their parents are doing a wonderful job with them. This is Dieudonné, that's his first name. It means God given. And this is his motorcycle taxi. He actually owns his own motorcycle, and so he doesn't have to pay anybody to use it during the day. And he's got a normal route that he runs, and that's how he makes his living. These are the Klutzes in front of their house. He works for a German pharmaceutical company distributing anti-malarial products. And she works on that foot-powered Singer sewing machine that you see there making dresses that she sells. This is Anna, who you met before. She was serving the salad before. This is her business. She makes donuts, not like American donuts, like French donuts, which are not nearly as sweet, but they're fried in oil. So she mixes up a big batch of batter here every morning, and she rolls them into different shapes, and there's the oil that she's going to start heating up. She does that in the morning, and then for the rest of the day, she sells these donuts, and that's how she makes her living. Okay, last country that we're going to see in the French region here is Ivory Coast, or Côte d'Ivoire, as it's known officially. There'd been a lot of violence here just of late. There was a civil war that went on for almost 6 or probably 8 or 10 years, actually. And these are the areas now where we have small groups. There are two little groups that are down near Abidjan, the capital, on the coast. And then there are 3 or 4 other little groups that are kind of coming into formation up in the area where a lot of the violence occurred just recently. These are some of the members around the Abidjan area in front of the hall where they meet. This was taken during the Feast of Tabernacles. And there was a lot, as I mentioned, a lot of violence around the area of Duikwe not too long ago. It's a town I have to drive through every time I go up country to visit the brethren there. And it was a very gruesome kind of violence, people being killed with machetes, being thrown alive down in wells, and other people thrown on top of them, and more people until people drowned or suffocated or whatever. It's just, it gets very mindless because of the passions are so high here. And again, in a situation like that, the church is thriving. We have a lot of people who are coming to the truth. I've baptized probably 30 people here in the last 4 years. There's just a lot of enthusiasm for these people learning the truth. This was a photo taken a couple of years ago. Again, I'm on the one on the right in the back if you're having trouble picking me out. And I'm wearing a formal, they call it a bubu. It's a relaxing garment for men of some importance, and I was very honored to be given one of those. This is the place where I baptized many of the people there. We try to get in and out of that water as quickly as we can. You don't want to spend time in stagnant fresh water in Africa because there is an amazing array of parasites that live in there, things that can do really incredible things to you. I won't go any farther with that right now, but if you're interested, you can look that up, Google it, and you'll see, you can find some amazing pictures of what the parasites there do. So we try to conduct the baptisms quickly and get out of the water. So that's a quick overview of what is going on in the French-speaking areas. Now, before I get to the little the brief message that I would like to share with you at the end, I want to give you some news of something else that happened last year, because I think it'll be very interesting for you to see. This is going to be in Ghana, which is an English-speaking country. It's not my responsibility, but as I was asked to help out with some leadership training that went on there last year. So we had ministers from four different countries in Africa that came together for 3 days of conferences. And here we are in the conference room. These are their participants. These are names that you may know. They come from Zimbabwe, Malawi, Ghana, of course, and Rwanda, and Zambia also. So these were the men. You can see Mr. Kylo is there. Tom Clark in the back with me. We're the ones that conducted them. And this was a first. To have a Pan-African conference like this was the first time that I know of that we've done something like that. It was very encouraging. We had Sabbath services with one of the local congregations in Elmina, the town of Elmina. This is the view over their wall. Not really good real estate, but it's what they could afford at the time. And here they are inside. It's quite a large congregation, very dynamic. They actually even have ceiling fans, which is they won't have air conditioning for a long time, but ceiling fans help quite a bit. And here we are fellowshipping after services. This is a group just nearby, probably half an hour away. There's another congregation in Agona. That's what the name of this place. And we had an afternoon service here after the morning service in the previous one. This is the Sabbath school. And children everywhere will always ham it up for the camera. It doesn't matter where you go. They like to do that. Also in Elmina, we had the chance to visit this castle. You probably didn't know that there are castles in Africa, but there are. This is Elmina Castle. It's on the coast, and it was built 2 years before Columbus discovered America. It was built by the Portuguese, and it was intended to be a trading post for things that the Portuguese wanted, like ivory, gold. There's a lot of gold in this area. And they would trade European goods with the African chiefs that lived in the area here. A couple of hundred years later, it became the slave trade began in earnest because of the cotton gin and a number of other things. The slave trade really took off, and this castle became a major point of sale for slaves. There would be wars between African tribes. Those captured would be sold to the Europeans who would come to this particular place. And there are others dotted along the coast of Ghana in particular. This is the inside of Elmina Castle. So as I said, 1490 is when it was built. Just outside the walls, there's a thriving market area where fishermen come in with their boats and sell their catch. And yet on the inside, there are reminders of a terrible time before. This was a cell. You see the skull and crossbones over the top of the cell. If slaves attempted to escape, they were just taken into these cells, the door was locked, and they were forgotten about. No food, no water, they were just left there till they died. And they waited until the next someone tried to escape again, and then he was thrown in with the remains of whoever had been there before. It was meant to be dissuasive, and it certainly was. This is, as you can see from the sign, this was an area where the slaves would wait as they were waiting for the boat. It was designed so the boat could actually sail right up next to it. There was just a little tiny gangplank, again, to prevent escape. So the door would open, and they would just kind of shove them from the cell into the boat, and off they went, never to come back again. This is the door, which they called the door of no return, because a slave who went through this door was never going to come back to Africa, would never see Africa again. Many of them died on the voyage over, and, of course, others went into slavery. But I thought this was, I wanted to share this with you because I think this is an apt illustration of why so many things in the world today are as bad as they are. I believe you were struck by the poverty in which some of our brethren live, and by the violent conditions that some of them have to confront. You've seen here photos of members in Europe who are scattered and few in number. They're fighting the same spiritual battles that you and I are, but they're doing it in a very different environment. Religion is still very openly tolerated in the United States, although that seems to be slipping away somewhat. But in Europe, it's a very hostile environment to Christianity. People don't want to know about it. They ridicule it. If you believe, if you have faith in something, you'll be belittled for it. So it's something that people have to keep very private. They're swimming against the current of a world that has really gone apart from God. And we also saw some slides of people who are living in abject poverty, whose life expectancy is 20 or 30 years less than yours and mine here, who are living in violent circumstances where they risk being robbed or shot in some sort of violent uprising at one place or another. And we just saw a place in the same area that's connected with human bondage on a great scale, where hundreds of thousands, even millions of people went from the life they knew to be taken away into slavery and never to return once again. All of this pointed me toward a very powerful lesson that the Bible instructs us in. And I think it would be good for us to spend a couple of minutes looking at this. I think this is a good way to tie all of this together and give us something to think about in the course of the next few days. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2, please, verse 26. 2 Timothy 2, verse 26. Paul's telling Timothy how to be a good minister. He says in verse 24, a servant of the Lord must not quarrel. He should be gentle, able to teach, be patient, in humility correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth, and that, notice verse 26 now, they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. You remember Mr. Armstrong's booklet, A World Held Captive? Some of you have been around long enough. You remember that, the picture of the globe with the bars in front of it? A world held captive. That's another way we could say this. This says that people who have not had the opportunity to come to God, who haven't repented, who don't know the truth, have actually been enslaved by Satan. They've been taken captive by him. He is the god of this world, with a small g. The Bible calls him that as well. And that's the real reason why the world is in such a mess. That's why we see our own country going down the drain morally and economically and in a lot of other ways. Satan hates this country, probably more than he hates other countries. And God's withdrawing his blessings now because of our national sins. In other places in the world, they've never really had those same kinds of blessings. And so, in their spiritual slavery, they have a life of misery, violence, death, and destruction. That's because the world is held captive. People are following Satan and doing his will without even knowing that that's what they're doing. Look at Luke chapter 4, verse 17. Luke chapter 4, verse 17. In Jesus' time, In the synagogue on the Sabbath, the adult males would take turns reading passages of the Scriptures. And in this occasion, Jesus is in the hometown of Nazareth. He's just been tempted by Satan, and he's about to begin his ministry now. And it says in verse 16, he came to Nazareth where he'd been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he was given the opportunity to speak. He was given the opportunity to read from the law. He was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah, and when he had opened the book, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who were oppressed, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." Then he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. Normally, the reader would give some commentary on what he had read. He would give an explanation of it, perhaps his understanding or what one of the scribes or the great teachers of the law would have said about it. He would explain something to it. But Jesus just read that passage and he sat down. And that's why the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. That was an unusual way to do the reading, just to read it and sit down and not say anything. And so they were curious, why is he doing this? What does this mean? What's going on here? And he simply said, "Today the Scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." With the start of the ministry of Jesus Christ, this prophecy was beginning to be fulfilled. The Spirit of God was on him. He'd been anointed to preach the gospel, the same gospel that you and I are involved in spreading today, by the examples of our lives, by the answers that we give, of the hope that lies within us, and by our collective efforts to get the gospel out by media means. And that message involves preaching deliverance to the captives. That doesn't mean getting prisoners out of jail, physically speaking. It doesn't mean buying slaves out of slavery, physically speaking. It means escaping from Satan's slavery. The message that we have been tasked with spreading through the work of our lives offers people liberation from the captivity that Satan has perpetrated on the world. The message that you and I have been entrusted to share with others is what can finally free humanity from the kind of suffering that we saw in those photos today and that I see every time I go over to that part of the world. And I long for the time when that's going to be the case. That message is a message that Jesus Christ preached, the gospel of the kingdom of God. It's going to free the captives. It's going to liberate those who've been oppressed. It's going to save those who are poor. You and I, brethren, have the privilege of being actively involved in that. You and I have the privilege of being part of the Church of God, which stands for freedom, spiritual freedom, liberation from the evils and the sufferings of this world. And I hope that that's something that you will think about. We stand for freedom. The gospel message that we collectively preach and that we have the opportunity to share individually is the means for humanity being freed from spiritual slavery and the beginning of the solutions to all the problems that we see around us in our own nation and really in all the nations around the world. That is a truly wonderful thing. It's a marvelous gift that God has given to us. And he's told us to share it with others because he's going to call others as well and give them the opportunity to know that freedom. Our brethren in the third world, the developing world, whatever term you want to call it, they have that vision just like we have that vision, but we need to make sure that it stays fresh in our eyes and we understand how important it is. They think about that every day because they don't have all the distractions that we can have if we choose to allow ourselves to be distracted. They don't have a lot of electric gizmos and gadgets and cable and internet and all of that sort of thing where we can waste hours and hours if we choose to do so. They don't do that. They can't. They live from hand to mouth most of the time. And you can bet they're thinking a lot about that deliverance. They really enjoy knowing that it's the case spiritually now, and they're looking forward even to a physical deliverance in the future. So, brethren, we need to keep ourselves free of the snares of the devil that we read about in that passage in 2 Timothy 2. Satan can snare people. He snared most of the people in the world. And he wants to snare us too and get us distracted from our mission. He would love to recapture us. We've been free, but he'd like to recapture us once again. So I would encourage you all to make sure that you don't compromise with the ways of the world. And also I would encourage us all to understand the importance of our continuing to work together to diligently preach the truth of God. Because it is that truth that one day will make all people free.